Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The streets of Iran are relatively quiet today. Troops in riot gear are out to break up any crowds, and the Iranian government has firmly rejected protesters' demands to redo the presidential elections. Russia said today it respects the election results, declaring President Ahmadinejad the winner. But France expressed concern about what it called brutal repression of protests. Let's start today with Scott Peterson, Middle East correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He's been covering this story from Turkey. And Scott, what are your contacts in Iran saying today?
Well, today it's a fairly quiet day, and I think what we're seeing is people beginning to try and get a better sense about what is going to be happening in the future. There's talk of a strike perhaps tomorrow. There was even talk of it that there might have been a strike today, which never seemed to materialize. It seems that that there's a growing sense from protesters that it's pointless now in many respects to actually go out on the streets because the police and the military and other security forces are there to prevent them from gathering. Although we have had a call for a day of mourning on Thursday by Mehdi Karoubi, who is one of the reformist candidates who was defeated. So it's just not clear yet what is going to happen, but certainly there is less fervor on the streets because there's simply more military force on the streets.
We hear the protesters are looking for other small ways of protest today, maybe turning on car lights, honking horns, shouting from rooftops. But has the opposition, at least as a vocal, taking to the streets protest movement, been effectively crushed?
Well, I think it's probably too soon even to say that, although the government, and I mean the security forces that have made very, very clear in the last few days that they will simply not tolerate any gatherings whatsoever, even on Monday when there was a gathering of several hundred people trying to get together at one of the main squares, Haftatir. Even though people appeared there, and even though they were mostly broken up, there were efforts even to just keep them walking. People were even separated when they were coming out of the underground metro station. There's a stop right there in the middle of that square. And so even a couple, if there were two people, they would be forced to separate and walk separately. So at least in this particular phase, people seem to have kind of calmed their passions. But remember, part of it, too, is that we haven't heard from Mir Hossein Mousavi, who is the main opposition leader. He hasn't been able to mobilize or at least direct people yet, so people aren't sure really what to do.
Well, and we're wondering, too, you're talking about Tehran. We saw images yesterday on CNN that were retrieved from the web of security police being chased by protesters in the northern part of Iran. Is it the same across the country?
Well, there have been protests, as far as we understand, in Tabriz, in Shiraz, in Isfahan. These are all very large cities. I think it's a lot less in more rural areas. But in several cities, these kind of things are going on. And I'm sure there are a lot of other things happening that we simply don't hear about.
What are the questions now emerging for you?
Well, I think that that one of the important things is to understand why it is that the supreme leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has decided to go with President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, why he thinks that he is the best choice. And the analysts that I've been speaking to in Tehran and outside are giving a number of reasons for this. And I think that one of them is that they feel perhaps that President Ahmadinejad has a very large support among both the Revolutionary Guards and the Basiji militia. He has spent the last 4 years giving these groups lots and lots of contracts and top posts. I mean, he's basically infiltrated Iran's government with people from these organizations. So they are loyal to him as he is loyal to them. And, of course, all of them are loyal to the supreme leader. So this is one of the reasons. Another one, too, which is also interesting, is that the supreme leader sees that President Ahmadinejad has conducted a very successful foreign policy over these last few years. Of course, in the West, all we hear about is Ahmadinejad's denial of the Holocaust and these diatribes against Israel. But the way that the supreme leader sees it is that this is a president who has overseen the advancement of Iran's nuclear program from zero centrifuges spinning enriching uranium 4 years ago to 7,000 today. And in another respect, regarding the United States, 4 years ago there was talk of regime change coming from Washington, but today, of course, coming from President Barack Obama, overture after overture trying to convince Iran to talk to the United States.
So, Scott, you're saying that the Supreme Leader, Khamenei, sees Ahmadinejad's tough talk as being the thing that got Americans anxious to talk to Iran?
That is one of the things. His perception is that Ahmadinejad's uncompromising stand has helped to cause the United States to realize that regime change is not possible, and therefore more willing to talk to Tehran. Now, of course, the primary reason for that, as we know, is that there's been a change of presidents in Washington, and that this is one of the primary drivers. But from Iran's perspective, and from that of the Supreme Leader, not only do you have Iran looking at the U.S.-Iran relationship this way and also seeing that it's made big progress on its nuclear program, but you've also got Iran declaring victories in the local fights that have gone on over the last few years. The war in Lebanon, for example, between Israel and Hezbollah, which is Hezbollah, of course, is backed by Iran, in the summer of 2006. And then more recently, this battle between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. Hamas, of course, is also backed, but to a much lesser degree, by Iran, but again, declared as a victory by Hamas and therefore declared as a victory by Iran.
Well, Scott, look out a little bit for us. Iranians have been traveling in support of the opposition leader, Mousavi. Iranian filmmaker Mohsen Makhmabaf held a press conference saying if Ahmadinejad holds on to the office, he won't have one day of quietness, that protesters would resort to general strikes and what he called civil resistance. But we're also hearing that a special court has been set up for detained demonstrators. So won't that dampen enthusiasm for, you know, civil demonstration and civil resistance in the future and possibly getting arrested?
Well, I think that's a real problem. I mean, I was in contact with someone in Iran today, and they were asking me the question, when is it right that we should pick up arms? Why is it that, you know, we're the ones who aren't doing anything? We're the ones who are nonviolent, but we're not achieving anything. What is the next step that we have to take? I mean, that person was demonstrating was the absolute frustration that they'll feel, and they feel it now, of course, because, you know, all of the tools of coercion are in the hands of the regime, not just the military, but also these ununiformed militia elements, which really can be very serious when you watch them in action. And these are also, you know, the regime is also capable with its intelligence networks and other things to really go after people once this is done. I mean, I think that once this has disappeared from our screens in terms of things actually happening on the streets, I think that this conflict, this face-off, is going to be going on for months and months afterwards, and people are going to be held accountable for all kinds of things that they did and did not do during this period. And analysts in Tehran are, you know, describing even circumstances like in Syria or even North Korea, was what one analyst said was the kind of securitization we might see in Iran after this.
Scott Peterson, Middle East correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, speaking to us from Turkey about the situation in Iran. Scott, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Let's go to Washington, D.C. now, where federal investigators are trying to find out what caused yesterday's rush hour train crash. 9 people are now confirmed dead. Dozens are hospitalized, some in critical condition, after one D.C. Metro train slammed into another, the deadliest crash in the system's 33-year history, and also the latest in a string of train crashes nationwide, including one here in the Boston area recently. Ian Urbina is with the New York Times D.C. Bureau. Ian, what are the big unanswered questions here?
There are really 3 main ones. One is, why didn't the computer system that is meant to avoid these situations by automatically stopping trains as they get too close to other trains, why didn't it enact the brakes, assuming it didn't? But most passengers who were on the train said they didn't hear or feel any engagement in the brakes.
This is in the oncoming train that was traveling quite quickly on a straight stretch and slammed into a train that was stopped. And the second question?
The second question is, what happened to the operator of that second oncoming train? She's dead, but she doesn't seem to have manually overridden the brakes, and she seems not to have noticed that the train was approaching the stopped train.
We should say that the operator is a 42-year-old woman. She hadn't been driving for long. And, you know, we know that recent accidents have focused on train drivers, in some cases using cell phones or text messaging. Is anyone saying that there's any evidence of that?
No one is just yet, because there's so little information about what happened. And that somewhat brings us to the third big question, which is that federal investigators and safety experts from the NTSB in 2006 warned city transit officials that they needed to either phase out the older trains that the city still uses, the so-called 1000 series, or upgrade them, retrofit them. And indeed, the train that crashed into the stationary train yesterday was a 1000 series. And the concern that the NTSB, the federal officials, had was that these older trains were not crash ready. They were not built in a way to withstand crashes. And the other recommendation the federal officials made was that all of the city's trains should be outfitted with these event recorders, which are, in essence, the little black boxes that we're all familiar with on planes. And those are very key for collecting data so that after accidents occur, investigators can know what exactly happened. Since the older series of trains in the city don't have those black boxes, it'll be very difficult for us to figure out certain things with regard to, you know, what was the operator doing or not doing and how fast was that train going, because the data just will have to be collected in other means if it can be collected at all.
Meanwhile, what impact is the crash having on D.C.?
You know, it tied up commuters this morning for the morning rush hour. You know, the Red Line is the most traveled of the lines on the metro system. Also, you know, New Hampshire Avenue, which is the huge street behind where the crash occurred, was closed for most of its lane. So that, you know, snarled car traffic. And it's just sent jitters through commuters who are used to taking the train and feeling very safe. And indeed, the train system is still much safer than getting behind the wheel of your car. But you never expect these things to happen. So a lot of commuters were expressing concern this morning.
Well, and outside of the terrible tragedy of people dying, looking ahead, what impact might it have on the city if those 1,000s are taken out of service because of questions about them as thousands of tourists descend on Washington, D.C. for the summer?
No, it's a good question. I think there could be two consequences. One, it could contribute to extra crowding on the trains because there'll be fewer cars, as you say, during a high season. And secondly, money. The city, like many cities, is dealing with a budget shortfall. And the notion of spending more money to buy new trains or upgrade old ones is probably not a very attractive option, but obviously one that the city will have to consider.
Ian Rubina with the New York Times Washington, D.C. Bureau. Ian, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, just ahead, a family physician says go to your doctor instead of the emergency room if your child bumps her head. It'll save a lot of money and unnecessary medical tests. But if it's your child that bumps her head, don't you want that CAT scan just to be sure? And later today, elderly drivers, some states are moving to retest them. But meanwhile, if adult children are concerned, how do you get mom or dad off the road? That's later. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to Here and Now. As President Obama continues to push for health care reform in a White House press conference today, activists on both sides are preparing a push of their own. On the left, the Health Care We Can't Wait 09 rally is scheduled on Capitol Hill this Thursday, and the left-leaning website Daily Kos is also calling for a Twitter tornado starting July 1st. On the right, the group Patients United Now is reportedly spending more than $1.5 million on ads against a proposed government-run insurance option. But what about reducing unnecessary medical tests? Dr. Richard Fried is the director of the Kimberton Clinic for Sustainable Medicine and a longtime family physician in Chester County, Pennsylvania. He says one of the problems is that there is a shortage of family physicians to coordinate care, but also people often don't go to a trusted family physician first. And he joins us on the line. Dr. Fried, welcome.
Thank you.
And you wrote an op-ed piece for the Philadelphia Inquirer and gave some examples of overspending that you've seen firsthand, including a patient of yours who came to you with a soft lump on her cheek. Her dentist first detected it. Take us through her trail.
The dentist felt this lump in her cheek, sent her to the head and neck surgeon after ordering an MRI. The head and neck surgeon ordered a CT scan and some months later another MRI. Then she came to see me. And when I felt it, it was obvious from the feeling that it was what's called a lipoma, which is a benign little growth. She wasn't even concerned about having it taken out. She just wanted to know what it was. So I called the head and neck surgeon to ask him why he had done all these tests. And he knew all along it was a lipoma. He admitted that to me. I'm not sure why he felt the necessity to do all these tests. But, you know, the cost came out to more than $10,000. I see unnecessary blood tests being done. One of the biggest problems we see is that when a test is ordered, often unnecessarily, a CAT scan or an MRI of some organ, often the organ that they're concerned about was normal, but they find an incidental finding of a little growth on the kidney or the liver or something like that. This is called an incidentaloma. In almost all cases, these incidental findings are harmless things that you were born with and you're going to die with. But once it's there in black and white and the radiologist says, incidentally, there's a lesion on the liver that we think is harmless, but malignancy cannot be 100% ruled out. Once that's dictated into the report, the doctor feels obliged then to order more tests to try to make sure that it's nothing, and sometimes it even leads to a biopsy, and it can lead to more dangerous, more expensive procedures.
But as you know, Dr. Fried, I can hear people listening and saying, yes, but there's that one chance that that lesion turns out to be cancer. So isn't it great that we have all of these tests that can find that one cancer?
I can understand that point of view, but how far are we willing to go to get 100% guarantee? You know, the cost differential between being 99% sure and being 99.99% sure is probably double. Is it worth double the medical cost in this country to get that extra little 1% guarantee? Well, I would say it's not.
Well, and you also point to cases where the cost is cumulative. For instance, the screening for osteoporosis, you say that it's recommended by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force that women are screened at age 65, yet most gynecologists begin screening at or near menopause. That's usually in the 50s. So what's the cost there?
Well, the charge for a DEXA scan, which is the standard screening method, is $700. The statistic they gave is that among women between 55 and 59, you'd need to screen more than 4,000 women to prevent one hip fracture. So I calculate that to be a cost of almost $3 million.
And you also point to local emergency rooms routinely performing these high-end tests on patients who may not need it. What do you see happening in the emergency room?
Well, a couple of things are happening. You know, if someone comes to a family doctor's office with fairly minor head trauma or abdominal pain, you examine the patient, you make an assessment, and in most cases, if there's a trust relationship between the doctor and the patient, you say, listen, this is a harmless bump on the back of the head, call me or go to the emergency room if A, B, or C should happen. But when this same patient is brought to the emergency room, there's not a trust relationship between the doctor and the patient, and the doctor may feel obliged to order a CAT scan on every single child or adult with any kind of bump to the head or any kind of abdominal pain. It's not only extraordinarily expensive, but in many cases, you actually end up putting yourself into more risk than if you use good medical judgment.
But also, you point out that one CAT scan of the stomach equals the radiation exposure of some 400 chest x-rays, and the cost, $1,800 for a CAT scan of the head, $3,400 for the abdomen, and that doesn't count the extra money to pay for the emergency room visit. Well, you've got some statistics here. You quote a report from the PricewaterhouseCoopers Health Research Institute that says up to $1.2 trillion of the $2.2 trillion spent on health care annually every year is wasteful spending. Half, $1.2 trillion. Who do you think is most at fault? Is it just doctors covering their practices, if you will? What's behind it?
Doctors blame our litigious society. Doctors blame patients who demand tests. Any doctor who's ever been sued for malpractice, they say that you're never the same, you practice differently. My point is this. It's a cultural thing and an ethical thing, I think. Doctors, like anyone else, practice in a culture. I'm not saying that getting doctors to order fewer tests will be the only answer that's needed to the healthcare crisis, but it's one that can be done without legislation. And, you know, if everyone agreed to it, it could be done overnight. We need to become aware that the decisions that we make affect not only ourselves and our patient, but, for example, I reckon that every unnecessary CAT scan or MRI risks throwing one more person off the rolls of the insured by raising the cost. Unnecessary test raises the cost of everyone's insurance, and if everyone does it, it makes the insurance no longer affordable for people at the bottom end of the spectrum. So I think it's a matter of education, a matter of changing the culture.
Dr. Richard Fried, director of the Kimmerding Clinic for Sustainable Medicine and a longtime family physician in Chester County, Pennsylvania. Dr. Fried, thanks so much for speaking to us about it.
Well, thank you very much, Robin. It's a pleasure to be on your program and to have an opportunity to air some of these thoughts.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, a conversation with Terry O'Neill, the newly elected head of the National Organization for Women, who won over a much younger woman of color. And still ahead today, some states are moving to retest elderly drivers, but should all drivers be retested? Back in a few minutes, Here and Now. Here in Massachusetts recently, an 89-year-old driver was charged with killing a toddler in a crosswalk. A 93-year-old mistook the gas pedal for the brake and smashed into a Walmart. We're going to look at how states across the country are dealing with the issue of elderly drivers. But first, Here Now's Sasha Pfeiffer reports on a push here in Massachusetts to mandate a road test specifically for drivers over 85.
Genevieve Priest is 89 years old and still has her driver's license, but says she's mostly given up driving. She travels with a tank of oxygen connected to a tube in her nose, and she doesn't feel as strong as she used to.
Well, I have a breathing problem. I don't have the energy I had before, and my eyes are not as good as they used to be. I would drive today if I had to, but I prefer not to.
She still comes, though, to this weekly quilting group at the Belmont Senior Center. She usually gets dropped off there by her husband, who's still driving at age 91.
He's been a tremendous good driver, but lately we're getting a little nervous about him driving because he doesn't seem to have the confidence.
Priest says she realizes there are older drivers on the road who shouldn't be. That's why she supports more frequent driving tests, but for young and old alike.
There are a lot of older people that they're just not good on the road, myself included, but they're driving. And I think that's very unsafe.
Liz Mowski is 72 and considers herself confident behind the wheel, although she avoids nighttime driving. Like Genevieve Priest, she thinks there should be periodic testing of all drivers. She says it's the younger ones who are a bigger menace on the road.
The young women who are driving now talk on the phone, they comb their hair, they put on eyebrow pencil or whatever they're doing while they're driving. And they're the ones who cause accidents. The number of seniors who cause accidents are really very small.
Mowski has a point. Statistics from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration show that 16 to 19-year-olds cause the most car crashes and that people get in fewer accidents as they get older. But that's in part because elderly people don't drive as much. When they do get behind the wheel, people 85 and older are almost three times as likely as teenagers to be involved in fatal accidents. So what is it like to be an elderly driver behind the wheel? Liberty Mutual, the insurance company, has designed a full-body suit that it says replicates the effect of aging on driving ability. The company claims that wearing the bulky suit, called the Senior Simulator, is like going through an instant aging process. I decided to try it out.
Now your seatbelt. You can't reach it, huh?
Yeah, it's hard. You have to sort of move your whole body to do what you could usually do with just with your neck.
I'm sitting in the driver's seat of a 2010 Toyota Camry with driving instructor Kevin Stromsky. A neck brace prevents me from turning my head to look behind me, and a knee brace makes it tough to move my legs. A spinal strap creates a small hunch in my back. I'm also wearing vision-impairing glasses and thick gloves that make it hard to maneuver the key.
It's tough, huh?
It's tough.
Took you three tries to find the ignition.
Yeah, I was sort of just hoping I hit.
We're in a big parking lot lined with pylons. Stromsky leads me through a series of exercises, including three-point turns, quick braking, and reversing using my side mirrors. Physically, I feel stiff and restricted, and my immobilized neck means it's hard to see the pylons behind and beside the car. When I put the car in reverse, I hold my breath and inch backwards, barely touching the gas.
So I feel like what I'm doing is just going as slowly as possible so that if I hit something, the damage will be minimal.
Yeah. It seems that way, because we're still... I haven't even seen the speedometer move.
I don't end up hitting any pylons, but there are several close calls. especially when I'm wearing the glasses that make me feel as though I'm looking through an ice-covered windshield.
We're way off again.
We're off course.
Oh, yeah. There's no way we're going to make this turn now.
Am I about to hit a cone?
You just barely missed it.
I do hit the cones during the quick braking exercise, though.
All right.
So did I do pretty badly?
Yes. If I were trying to teach you how to do this in our class, I would not have passed you.
Dr. Bob Stern at the Boston University School of Medicine specializes in what happens to the brain as it ages, and specifically in how aging affects driving. Stern says the neck brace and glasses are the most realistic part of it. But overall, he thinks the senior simulator is a gimmick.
Don't try this at home. But probably the best way to simulate the cognitive impairment would be to have a few drinks so that your brain is overall slowed, so that your reaction times are slowed, that you're unable to multitask as well.
Okay, that story from Here and Now's Sasha Pfeiffer. We're going to be back in 30 seconds with advice for senior drivers and their families. If you've got a question, send it to letters@hereandnow.org. Back in a minute. We're talking about whether to require more restrictions on elderly drivers following a spate of accidents. Here, Massachusetts lawmakers are talking about extra tests for drivers starting at the age of 85. A AAA survey found that drivers older than 65 were 25% more likely to get into accidents than middle-aged drivers. But state laws restricting senior drivers vary widely, and the issue of whether or not to drive is a touchy one for many seniors and their families. Well, Dr. Elizabeth Dugan is a gerontologist at the University of Massachusetts in Boston, and author of The Driving Dilemma, The Complete Resource Guide for Older Drivers and Their Families. Dr. Dugan, let's start right away. You recommend changes, but you don't support age-based testing, which is what states are either considering or doing. Why?
The short answer is it doesn't seem to work. There's no evidence that it results in a reduction of fatalities or crashes. States rely on two policies or approaches to limit crashes. One is licensing, and then the other is medical reporting. And in the licensing side, some states, you can try accelerated renewals, increased testing, vision testing, driving quizzes, road tests, even physical or cognitive function tests are being pilot tested in some places. So there are a number of approaches that are tried across the country in regards to the licensing approach, and then the medical reporting procedures where a physician or other professional or concerned person can submit reports. That's another policy. So the evidence, there was an important study that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 2004 that compared the different policies and looked at fatality data by states. And what they found was they compared accelerated renewals, vision tests, in-person renewals, and a fourth thing that I'm blanking on.
That's okay. Yep.
And what they found was that in-person renewal was the only policy that resulted in a reduction in fatality.
Well, now let's stop there because you listed these off. Are you saying then that just retesting somebody by, let's say, they don't actually speak with anyone, they come in maybe with a group of people and they do a test, doesn't tell you as much as requiring that people come in and physically present themselves to someone?
Exactly. The authors, although this went beyond their data, but they hypothesized that in-person renewals may work because if someone is too medically impaired to get to the RMV or the DMV for a test, they're too medically impaired to drive, and so they screen themselves out because of the in-person renewal process. And then also it may trigger something. The counter personnel may react, and they may see or detect gross impairment,
sure.
And then that triggers further assessment.
Well, so that's your stand on that. But as you know, two states, I think it's New Hampshire and Illinois, now require road retests specifically for drivers over 75. Massachusetts looking at tests over 85. And the reaction is across the board. People saying, 85, that's too late. That's way too late. Others saying everybody should be retested because we age differently. Is that one of the issues?
Yeah, it would be much easier to regulate if we all fell apart at the same age. And so we all knew at age 75 or 85 we'd be completely incapacitated. But biomedical research has shown over the past several decades that humans age at vastly different rates due to genetics, environmental factors, and behavioral factors. So you can think of someone, I'm sure, who's in their 50s or 60s and in terrible shape and shouldn't be driving, and someone who's in their 80s or 90s and is healthy and with it and active and perfectly capable of driving.
But can states really afford that? Can they afford to either retest people or even require people over 65, let's say, to come in? It's that much more work.
It is a quandary, and there are expenses involved in doing this, but there are also expenses involved in not doing anything, and the recent crashes only highlight that. Mm-hmm. And just the fear and anxiety that people have about driving and about the issue. So one approach that's very promising, California has a nice pilot study that they've been approaching. They've been testing for several years, actually, and it uses a tiered approach. So you've got in-person renewals, step one, and the renewal period goes, and the person comes in for a vision test or some short screening. And any problem at step one pushes the person to step two, which is, you know, vision, cognition, some mm-hmm. type of functional assessment. Any problem there pushes the person to step three, which is, you know, full assessment. And at any point in the steps, or it could be a referral from a medical provider, could also put someone into one of the higher steps, the person could have their license revoked or their driving privileges revoked. But the nice thing about that is you're focusing on people that are at risk, that pose the greatest risk, instead of picking an age out of the hat. And then, you know, we've got this baby boom cohort coming. So it will be expensive to do it now. It's going to be very expensive in 10 or 15 years.
This is such a difficult thing. If you don't have this kind of screening in your state, let's talk about what police and doctors can do. And your own story illustrates that sometimes something has to be done. You had your mom suffered from dementia and forgot that she wasn't supposed to drive.
Right. And this, you know, just is a good chance to keep me humble. So the first time we went through this with my mom, we discovered that she had a vision problem, macular degeneration. And that was a point our family got together, made a great alternative transportation plans, problem solved, very positive. Then within about 24 months, she started exhibiting symptoms of dementia, and as we hadn't been in a rush to sell the car or anything because it had just gone so well and the services in place were working. And so the second time we went through the issue, it was just about as bad as it could be, and I had to partner with her physician and the police and get her.
Well, let's talk about physicians and police. We understand 9 states require physicians to report medical conditions that might impair driving skills, and police can revoke someone's license if they determine at a traffic accident that that person is impaired. So first of all, do doctors follow through and make that report? And secondly, we hear anecdotally that if adult children call police and say, I'm trying to get the keys away from my dad, he's rolling down the driveway, when the police will come, they are not authorized if that person, for instance, knows their name and knows what they're doing. So doctors and police.
Yeah, that's. I think that one of the key solutions lies in the medical profession, because who's in the best position to evaluate your physical and cognitive function but your healthcare provider? So there are a number of fixes to make that work. So physicians, healthcare professionals should have some provision of immunity from lawsuits. So if they report someone who's medically unfit to drive, they won't get sued. Mm-hmm. That removes a huge barrier. Mm-hmm. Also, the clinical guidelines specifying when to report someone or when someone's not safe came out in 2004, I believe, and were not well disseminated, and there are new guidelines that are due out this summer. But again, the problem is getting guidelines into the hands of the healthcare providers that are seeing the older drivers. So I think getting the healthcare providers some protection and improving the medical reporting system is a big solution.
Well, meantime, it's such a hard thing for adult children and older parents. You say adult children would rather discuss their parents' funeral with them than whether or not to drive. The AARP has a 12-point checklist for older drivers, asking them to identify things. Can they adjust their seat? You can do that. We'll have it on our website. But just a few seconds here. The absolute last thing to do, call a doctor or a medical board to try to get a parent off the street?
If you can talk, do talk about it. Get over the queasiness. And if you can't get any resolution that way, get your parent into multidisciplinary assessment so you can find out for sure if they're safe or not.
Yeah. And again, know that sometimes people in their 90s can drive very safely. Dr. Elizabeth Dugan, gerontologist at the University of Massachusetts here in Boston, author of The Driving Dilemma, the complete resource guide for older drivers and their families. We'll have information at our website, hereandnow.org, where if you have thoughts, we'd love to hear them there as well. We'll be back in just 1 minute. Dr. Dugan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Here and Now. The old Army Air Force base at Roswell, New Mexico is closed now, but questions linger. Did a flying saucer with aliens on board really land there in 1947? The BBC's Kevin Connolly went to investigate.
When you hear thunder and lightning in New Mexico, you do find yourself wondering if it's really just another storm. It was, after all, on a night like this that a flying saucer crashed near here in 1947, forcing the American government into one of history's great cover-ups. The possibility the aliens might return from the trackless depths of the heavens is what draws us here. It's why watchers of the skies... well, watch the skies, obviously. Eerily, when I arrived in Roswell, it seemed for a moment I'd found myself frozen back in 1947, year of the crash.
Late this afternoon, a bulletin from New Mexico suggested that the widely publicized mystery of the flying saucers may soon be solved. Army Air Force officers reported that one of the strange disks had been found and inspected sometime last week.
Luckily, I quickly realized I'd simply stopped to ask for directions at the office of the local neighborhood watch scheme, and that the ex-cop who runs it, Richard Lucero, is something of a Count Basie buff.
I have gotten a couple of phone calls from our citizens when they see something up in the sky. They consider it to be a UFO. I guess we're all UFO conscience here. And they'll see a weather balloon, and I'll get the phone calls. Sir, there's a strange object in the sky. You need to look into this.
Now, say what you will about aliens, for all the many concerns that crowd their giant brains, they're always good at spotting when the tourist industry in a small American town could use a shot in the arm.
See the little UFO at the corner of the light?
Uh-huh.
That's where you're going. Hold it right there. Okay, let's take a peek.
In the photo gallery at Roswell's UFO Museum, things are busy. This is where you get your picture taken, talking to an alien or being beamed up into a flying saucer.
Oh, I like that one.
The museum is run by Julie Schuster, whose father was an officer at the Air Force base where they took the crashed flying saucer and its dead alien crew. Not just any officer either. He actually wrote the press release confirming the alien landing, which was put out before the suits descended from Washington with some hastily concocted cover story about a crashed weather balloon.
My father saw the bodies. My father saw the craft. My father knew a lot of the people that were involved in the incident, including the colonel. My daddy didn't lie.
There's just too many people involved around the world that say, I saw, that have taken pictures.
Well, nobody's ever taken a clear one, have they?
You know, they're real iffy.
I mean, aliens seem to choose people who don't know how to operate a camera in front of.
But if you're sitting there and you see something, your first thought may not be to pull your camera out and say, wait, just a minute, big orange object. Let me focus my camera.
We're standing in front of the most important building of the millennium, if it happened.
The Roswell Air Force Base is closed now, but outside an old hangar which survives, I met Dennis Balthazar, a retired engineer who's now a tireless and meticulous historian of the Roswell incident and a subscriber to the view that space travellers helped to build the pyramids. I arrived expecting to find him hopelessly naive, but to be honest, Dennis is so persuasive that I left feeling rather naive myself. After all, what kind of idiot believes it's the president who really calls the shots in America?
There is no limit to what our government will do to keep a lid on something.
Do you think when someone like Barack Obama is elected, they tell him about the nuclear weapons, and then they say, incidentally, Mr. President, and they open a drawer, and there's like an alien in there?
You have to understand that the president of the United States is a temporary employee. Basically, he can't be trusted with information like this.
The ufologists are not alone in watching the New Mexican skies. High above sea level on the dried-out ancient lake bed of the San Augustine Plain, the distant mountains chop the skies into jagged lumps of blue. Once, ancient native civilizations pondered the stars here. Now the American government's very large array of radio telescopes does pretty much the same job. Dave Finley is one of the ponderers.
So far, the VLA has made observations out to 13 billion light years away.
When we make a program like Broadcasting House and broadcast it, does the signal keep going forever? I mean, might there be a very large array somewhere else which is eventually going to pick this up, this conversation?
The signal, in fact, does go out forever. The problem is it gets weaker and weaker as it goes.
If you can still hear me out there, New Mexico really is a curious place. Holy ground for UFO true believers, of course, but home to lots of real science, too. America developed the atomic bomb here and still tests missiles to this day. And in that proximity of science fact and science fiction lies a possible explanation of the Roswell incident. That's if you believe the official version offered me by Dave Finley as we strolled around his radio telescopes.
There is a gentleman at New Mexico Tech who was part of a project that put balloons in the upper atmosphere back in the late 1940s, trying to discover whether or not the Soviets had as yet exploded an atomic bomb. And this gentleman will tell you that at the time of the Roswell incident, he lost one of those balloons, and that he is absolutely convinced that's exactly what they found.
All this official science stuff does not deter UFO researchers like Dennis Balthazar, who inhabits a frightening world of shadow governments and special agents who will leave your bones to bleach in the desert sun if you speak the inconvenient truth. Last word to Dennis.
Welcome to the United States government. They're good at keeping secrets.
And if you are a UFO believer, of course, you may have hoped for a very different type of report from the deserts of New Mexico. But here's the thing. You're right. There really is a layer of government 27 levels above top secret, which keeps an eye on these things. This is not the script I sent in. It's just the script that they sent me back. Spooky, huh?
So maybe the truth is out there. The BBC's Kevin Connolly in Roswell, New Mexico. And before we go, a passing to note.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, here's Johnny!
For 30 years, Ed McMahon was Johnny Carson's loyal sidekick on The Tonight Show, creating a character that others would inhabit. Think Andy Richter and Conan O'Brien, or in satire, Larry Sanders and his obsequious partner Hank Kingsley. Ed McMahon died early today in Los Angeles at 86. He likened himself to a pitcher's favorite catcher and said, more revealingly perhaps in his autobiography, "I did what had to be done when it had to be done. I was there when Carson needed me, and when he didn't, I moved down the couch and kept quiet. The most difficult thing for me to learn how to do was just sit there with my mouth closed. If I was going to play second fiddle, I wanted to be the Heifetz of second fiddlers." Well, with The Tonight Show's signature farewell song, we salute TV's first second banana.
Maybe I should have saved those leftover dreams.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Here's that rainy day they told me about.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.